It's now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. The God Journey.
Well, Brad Cummings is back in the house.
I am.
Welcome, dude.
Thank you.
It has been a long season here where we've been all over different places everywhere. So
I haven't been jet-setting quite like you. You were in Russia.
Yeah, that was crazy. Went to New Zealand back and then to go the other side of the world and, oh my gosh, 11 hours.
Would it have been easier just to stay on that side and scoot up the coast?
No, it's the other, they're the other side of the world from each other. It was 11 hours time difference between me and Russia. But
wow.
Never been to Russia, wanted to go. I don't know if I've mentioned this in the podcast. I mentioned to a lot of people. My brother's passion was 1969, went to university to train for ministry and double majored in Russian because he had a passion for going
really?
To Russia. Yeah. And so I guess I haven't shared on the podcast. If you don't know it, that looked like you. That's news to you.
It is news to me. I didn't know you had any Russian interests.
He had a passion from the very beginning of his life to take this to Russia. So he double majors in these things. He prays through his life. And then when the Iron Curtain falls, he's got multiple sclerosis so developed that he doesn't have a chance of going there. So he never got to go. Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I look back and I don't know how much his prayer shaped that. I don't think he's the only one, obviously, that was praying for Russia. But I think my brother had a stake in his heart there. And I don't know. I don't know how. I always look at that, you know, even when I was at his funeral and spoke a bit at it. And I look at that passion as going, that wasn't fulfilled in a way that we know in this world.
Nope.
But I don't think God measures our whole life in this world. So however that fulfills. But I when I started traveling a bit, I knew if I ever got an invite to Russia, I would go. I would go for my brother. I would just go be among the Russian people and have a taste of that. So when I got invited to St. Petersburg, I just said, I'm coming. It's not one of those trips you know you prayed long about and really discern. I'm going to go. I'm going to go find out what God's doing in Russia, and I'm going to celebrate my brother there. And he passed away. Oh, boy, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but I think it's about 13 years ago. And he was my oldest brother. And he would have loved to do the things I do as a pastor for a while. And there was a Bible teacher in a private Christian high school. And he would have loved to do the things I do and never got the chance quite in the same way. So, yeah. So it was emotional from that standpoint.
I was going to say that had to be rather kind of a whole mixture of stuff.
It was, and it was fabulous. And St. Petersburg, I guess if you go to Russia, you want to, I don't know if you want to start in St. Petersburg, because it is one beautiful, beautiful city, probably one of the most beautiful cities in Europe, and I was not ready for that. I mean, this was the former capital. I didn't hear that much about St. Petersburg, but that's because we called it Leningrad after Lenin came from there and, you know, took the revolution, murdered billions of people, or millions anyway. And so I just didn't know what to expect. I got there, and I did a little reading before I went. I'm not I've learned to at least be up to speed a little bit where I show up in the world.
It's a Michelin triptych, yeah, baby.
But we spent the first 2 days just walking through the city center, the palaces, the museums, the beauty, the cathedrals. I mean, it's Eastern Orthodox. It's
smells and bells.
It's smells and bells and mosaic. I tell you, they're a lot more colorful than their Western counterparts.
Yeah.
They're little basilicas. I'm telling you what, they look like Disney. They look like Walt Disney built them.
If I could smell, gosh, some of the incense stuff is amazing.
You can't smell.
Not very good.
Oh, wow. I knew it. I went in and didn't even notice the incense, so I guess I don't smell either. It wasn't burning when I was in there. We were the main one there, which they say is prettier than St. Basil's, which is the big one in Moscow you always see at the Kremlin, near the Kremlin. But this is one called the Church on Spilt Blood.
The Church on Spilt Blood.
Yeah, and you think it'd be Jesus' blood, but it wasn't. It was a Russian czar who was murdered. He was stabbed there, died later. It wasn't.
And they built a church there.
Actually, he was killed.
Was he a good czar?
He was inside. I didn't sort all that out. I don't know who was good. And who was bad. You know, but you go through these palaces. Same thing I did in Rome last summer. You go through these palaces, and here is built these opulent, by today's standard, opulent. And you're going, how do you do this on the backs of a poor citizenry? I mean, it's all just, we get everything. We're royalty. And you're just dirty little people who serve us. And that just makes me puke. It makes me puke when those people who do it in the name of God, and when those people do it in the name of royalty. And those are the most beautiful buildings in Europe. They are. There's no doubt you walk in there and go, the massiveness, the construction. We went to Catherine's Palace outside St. Petersburg. It is huge. Everything's gold, ornate, inlaid, this, that, and the other thing. And
okay, I'm not defending them.
Yeah,
because I don't know that I know enough to even bother. But
well, don't worry if you are, because I'm too tired to jump across here and kill you.
I got jet lag, Wayne.
You got jet lag, Wayne. And honestly, I'm not going to share a lot about this, but I when I got there, there's some stuff going on at home that really just ate my life up while I was there.
Oh.
And people didn't know. I told some. I just said, be in prayer. This is not an easy trip, and I'm dealing with some stuff that's going on back in L.A. that I couldn't get my head around and heart around when I was there. It cost me sleep. It cost me tons of time trying to do what I could by email. And I was just exhausted the entire trip. And I averaged probably, this is my Brad Cummings trip, because I think I averaged 4 hours of sleep a night.
Oh, you have to be sort of wired to do that.
I'm seven and a half. No, I'm a seven and a half minimum. I've not even slept a good night since I've been home. So, So if you're worried about me coming across the table and choking you to death, it's not going to happen. But the weird thing about in the middle of all the throes of the emotion of what I'm going through at night, and some of it was incredibly deep as God was dealing with some things in me, and then get up the next day and go give away whatever I had to people. And I had the sense, often some of these, particularly when I got to Holland after I was in Russia, I was giving away stuff that I just knew was not my stuff. I just knew it was better. I just knew God. I think I was so tired I couldn't resist what God wanted to do. God gave some really good stuff away to people who were hungry, so that was cool. So I mean, interrupt you, but go back to whatever you're saying about not defending the czars.
I sometimes wonder, I mean, because, you know, we weren't there. I wonder if there wasn't a genuine passion at the beginning of just trying to capture the grandeur and the beauty and the amazingness of God, because there is some aspect of that in those art and those buildings. You end up just going like, you know, it could all be just awful oppression. It could. I wasn't there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I do end up going like,
I'm more talking about the palaces there than just the cathedrals, which are
right,
a little different. But and to really see why they built them. I mean, part of it, and I think it's more clear in the Eastern Orthodox than it is probably in the Western side of things, but the whole inside is these mosaics, at least the ones I was in, these mosaics of all the Bible stories, because people not being able to read, that's how they taught them the Bible stories.
I think it's weird. When I was in seminary, I had a professor that had decided to leave the vineyard to become an Eastern Orthodox dude, and all smells and bells. And I'm going like, dude, from
so you know, you don't mean smells and bells as a diminutive.
No, I'm sorry.
I'm just checking.
My Southern California casual,
mock what I can in fun.
No, but he got absolutely passionate about all that stuff, with a captured sense of the original meaning behind why that was important. And when he would share out of that, I sit there like, okay, that's totally different than anything I've ever been exposed to.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And if it means that, wow, that's not what I was exposed to. So I've always kind of like, gosh, it seems like a foreign language, something that's really weird. And I've sort of recognized, so oftentimes when we don't understand the original context of what some of this stuff comes from, we get the second, third generation of, you know, why do you cut off the end of the ham? And it's like, well, because the pan was so short.
Not because it made the ham taste better. Yeah.
I think when you look at all that, it's like, okay, what's going on there? Because when you encountered the people from Eastern Orthodox stuff, how do they see God? Is God is someone close and involved in their life? Is he distant? Are they sorting that out? Where are they at?
Well, I didn't meet much of that because I'm there for other reasons, so I didn't get to talk to... I mean, Eastern Orthodoxy, I mean, very few held on to it in Russia. I mean, it was, you know, the communist regime, it just stamped that stuff out. People weren't free to meet, gather, and get to know God intimately. And, you know, so I, you know, when I look at it all, it's, man, the holy doors, these ornate things, only the priest can go through, and it's also old covenant kind of... To me, it's all whether it's the palaces of the king of the Tsars or the basilicas or cathedrals of the quote unquote church. It's just all the opulence. We're special. You're dirt. I mean, I so detest that mentality, and I so detest architecture that embeds it. Even as I'm saying, I went in the Amber Room, which is a famous room. It's an entire room in the palace of Catherine that was built when she was the granddaughter of Peter the Great or whatever, but it was built, the entire room's out of amber, just little pieces of amber all pieced together, the entire room. And it's just, it's one of the wonders of the world, literally. And you just walk in there and go, I mean, I wouldn't want my bedroom like that. It's just gaudy as gaudy could be. But it was a present from somebody, and, you know, gee, that was something. And you just go, man, how is this? You got people starving in bread lines. And the royalty consider it okay to live in absolute opulence. And
yeah, there's something a little off there.
Yeah, that's where I see the religious buildings, too. They went to the same thing. It's just, but it gave the, on the one hand, it gave the common man a sense of being part of something great. He was part of something beyond him. And that's probably from that side, you know, why they did it. On the other side of it, it's the royalty of the priesthood that just creeps me out. And how old covenant the buildings are with the Holy of Holies and special places. I mean, it really is more old covenant than new.
Yeah, it was weird. When I was in Jerusalem, we were seeing some of the, you know, different churches. It felt like a turf war. Yeah. So it's like,
it
okay.
is. It I is.
I enjoyed the gypsy guy the most because he didn't have a building in the game. So, yeah. You know, I was going, wow, that's cool. But we were in this line to go see the sepulcher or whatever it was, and I had shorts on because it was hot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not good.
Well, I wasn't allowed in because you had shorts on. You can't go in. That's like, that's completely inappropriate. Yeah. I'm going like, I'm not naked. I got shorts.
Oh, we were in Rome the same way. I didn't wear shorts ever. And it was hotter than blazes because you couldn't go into these places. And I knew it. So.
And then, then you watch some of the dress of these Hasidics, and it looks like they're in Russian garb, and it is 80, and they're sweating.
Oh, gosh.
I don't understand. But, you know, I look at that, and as opposed to just wiping all that, part of me goes, there's got to be something there at the beginning that was cool. For it to have lasted toward this long, as weird as it may be, there's got to be something. I just always have a sense of curiosity of going, like, what's the original story?
Hmm.
What's going on there, and why do they do that?
Yeah.
And when it becomes this dead form down the line, you end up going like, guys, really? Do we know why we're doing this?
Yeah.
And if it's with meaning and purpose, awesome. But if it's not, could we let it go? And I don't know.
Yeah.
So who'd you encounter in Russia? I mean, what were the people like?
These were brothers and sisters, and I mean, the group I was with was just a broad smattering of people that have kind of latched onto the shack. He loves me. It was a mission group in America, kind of was coordinating some things relationally with college students, and then they all got involved in, you know, the thing you're supposed to do, going to church. And amazingly, they mostly, not all, there's one guy there that I met that I loved. I love this guy's heart and spirit. He's a very outgoing guy. He is a Jewish messianic Lutheran priest trying to build his congregation, and I loved
what's that look like.
I loved it. I didn't go. I have no idea. But he's right alongside people who just have given up church at all. There's one group that came up from Moscow. They call their place the Trauma Center. That's what they call. Which they had a big church. They had a big thing going. It was all the machines and props and all that stuff. And then it just they. I love the fact that people I was with got disillusioned early. I mean, you know, in America, it's taken some of those 250 years to get disillusioned with some of the conventions of Christianity. They didn't make it through a generation where they're going, this isn't good enough. And he loves me, So You Don't Want Church Anymore. We went to a Russian bookstore, a secular bookstore, and there's So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore sitting in the deal.
Wow.
And so, yeah, and that's obviously very threatening to the
institution,
powers that be, because the slice of Russian believers is incredibly small, period, even of those who actually go to a building, and then to have some of those not be in that building, that's threatening. But we had about 50, 60 of them at a retreat out away on toward Finland from St. Petersburg, and just had days to dialogue and discuss, and I love the question. And it's funny because
what were they asking?
Oh, gosh, everything. I mean, we're into the atonement, huge, the cross. And, you know, actually Eastern Orthodoxy has a better view, I think, of the atonement than Western does. So, but most of them weren't influenced by Eastern Orthodoxy because they haven't been part of that. They never were. Most of these are from evangelical kinds of
So they're just waking up out of communism, or is that a wrong stereotype?
No, I think the whole culture is. I mean, they're finally talking about now. They've moved from when communism fell, and this is their observation. The passion was consumerism. Now they could buy things they couldn't buy, and there's this emerging middle class.
Okay.
And now that's kind of shifting where the middle class, for the last, 20 years, it's all been about me, and I haven't, and I'm going to get.
And that's not working.
Well, now what's emerging is a citizenry that cares about the common good more than they care about their own consumer.
That's encouraging.
Yeah, so they're having a few demonstrations, and I'm telling you, the cops are right there. As soon as the demonstration breaks out, you're hauling you off, hauling your tail off to prison. And yeah, and I was in the town, you know, where Lenin's whole thing began. This big statue of Lenin. They say he's trying to hail a cab. He's got his arm out like this, and it was pretty cute. And but right at near that point was where World War II, the Nazis had come to the brink of the city,
right.
And there was a 900-day siege of St. Petersburg that failed. And they preserved the city. That was the farthest line, the Nazis, which was just outside the gates of outside the city center. So, I mean, there's just a real triumphant sense that they resisted that. But then the oppression they immediately went under the whole communist regime. So they really are, in many ways, just coming out of that. And
so what's the lens that they have when they're looking at God? Who are they seeing?
Well, the people I was with, because they've been reading the Shack, he loves me, so he went church anymore, they're really learning to find this God of affection. But boy, they had a ton of questions. They're sorting out, how do we know he's this way? And that hunger
too good to be true, kind of?
Yeah, and how do we catch that? You know, because it's all trying to wrap my head around the theology of it, but how does God introduce them to himself as a presence in the universe, not just a concept we're talking about?
Do they have entrenched ideas that he's more the God of wrath and judgment, or is it just... I have no idea.
Yeah, I think that's the bias. Yeah, I think they lean that way. They're not wholly committed, you know, dyed in the wool, grabbed that up. I think they've already had that shaken somewhat. But you don't find, I mean, there's not a whole lot of religious interest in Russia. So you don't catch they have this, you know, like this religious right in America, this God, the God of vengeance and war, and, you know, not on that page. Mm. So it'll be interesting. He Loves Me is just about to come out. It's been kind of on PDF files, people have been sharing it that way. But it's coming out as a book in a couple of weeks. They're hoping to get it done before I got there, but they didn't get it done. And the picture they're using on the cover is the picture that's actually a Rembrandt painting of the Return of the Prodigal. Yeah, who is it that talks about in his book, The Return of the Prodigal? Henry Nouwen. And we went to the Hermitage Museum, and I didn't know this. Hermitage Museum is the second rated museum after the Louvre in the whole world. And I mean, there must have been 40 Rembrandt paintings in there, and one of them that. Yeah, and we got to that spot. The guy that took me, Michael, my host, who you guys met last week on the podcast, if you didn't hear it, you might go back and hear Michael and Susan talk a bit. But we got to that room, and it was packed with this tour and people and everything. I was kind of disappointed. And then they all moved on, and we were alone in front of that painting. And I don't like the painting for a lot of reasons. There's a lot about it that's just kind of, but to be there in that painting and then turned around and right behind was, I think, a better painting, but it was Abraham sacrificing Isaac and the angel entry, another Rembrandt. That was amazing. And then we saw the Van Gogh stuff, and so that was all very moving. It was amazing.
I think we have an amazing planet that we know so little of. It's just, to me, it's fascinating to go, okay, so here's what we see. What do they see?
Yeah.
What do they know of God? I mean, because you look at how God works through different cultures, and it's like they're looking through a different lens. They're looking through the lens of their experience. And I just think when you can have a chance to dialogue with all of that,
yeah,
it's fascinating stuff that comes out.
I had a ball in Russia. I mean, the conversations, the ones I was awake for and remember somewhat. And the people I met, how gracious they were and how hungry they were. And I'm really excited. And how much some of them have paid a huge price to go on more of a relational journey when their sending missions organization couldn't get them to jump through the same hoops they've been jumping through. They were hoping, like most of us, I'm getting disillusioned, but I'm seeing something more real. You're obviously going to be excited about this with me. They're not so excited with you, and they're going to cut you off if you don't jump through these hoops, and you're not thinking those hoops are the best way to help people engage this journey. And yeah, that was interesting.
Are you having to work through translators, or did people know English? Okay.
Yeah. And not only translation, which exhausts me, but accents, trying to hear even the people who are speaking English. And I just, that both there and Holland, and already being tired and trying to stay in a conversation and hear what's being said and then hear the heart through the translator. But yeah, that was a deal.
Wow.
Yeah. And I got a little bit of a dose. When I got to Holland, I got a little bit of a, this was interesting, a little bit of a dose of the old driving, worship leading style that, man.
Doesn't do you so good.
No, I don't care. I can get in the songs and sing and enjoy God. But I think what I really, both places where we had a little taste of this, okay, a big dose of it. I could see how this ruins people to come and be with God. Because it's all how we ascend to the holy place. It's all, we've got to come to Him and, you know, you've got to give this up, and he's on this high mountain, and come and approach, and it's all the royalty, it's all the palace stuff in the czars, it's all that. Huh. And I found myself telling this story a number of times, and I think I may have told it on a previous podcast, but about 6-8 months ago, when my daughter just had one of those overwhelming mommy days, and, you know, sick kids, and one that was relapsing from something, and a 6-month-old kid, and she was having a tough day, and I didn't know it. I had not a clue. I'd had dinner near where she lives, and I met a guy for a lunch appointment. I was driving back, and I had a lot to do, and I just felt nudged to pull off the freeway and just go up and give the grandkids a hug. That's basically what I was going to do. And because Julie lives in the house I used to live in, as I pull in and punch I have the remote control code in my car. So I punched up for the door to open, and my daughter standing in her garage alone in tears.
Mm.
And when she saw me, she ran to me, and I got to hold my daughter and let her cry for a while. And I have not felt more like a father in the last 10 years than that moment. And I love my daughter. We have great times. Jay was over yesterday. I mean, Jay and I have a special friendship. I love my little girl. And but to be there at a moment of her worst pain. And so I asked people, I said, which do you think is the picture of God? He's in this palace way over there. Come up these steps, clean your stuff, make sure you go in there, got the right clothes on, the right protocol, you know, everything, because you don't want to take God off, or you don't want to dishonor the deity, or you don't. Or it's really the incarnation about God showing up in our worst moment in tears and holding us. And I think that even the difference between seeking God, I've got to find him where he is, and turning around and finding God already having come to you. And that really resonated with people. I think people, I'm sure it was pretty challenging to the worship guy, because he had just driven us up this high holy mountain. But I just went, you know what? It really is more important that people see that God's the God who comes near us. He's not the guy going, okay, I'm over here, and when you're going to clean your life up and get out of your stupid sins and your stupid doubts and kind of get all that fixed, then you can come before me. And I know so many people only feel like they can get there when they feel clean, and they just, I'm all good, and God's forgiven everything, and I'm, you know, and it's not. Hey, I'm right here. I'm in the midst of your worst crud and your tears and your pain and your lostness. And really, I know we're told to seek God, and I'm all about seeking for him to see what he's doing. But I'm not about, you got to climb up 500 steps to get to some high holy mountain and angels singing and all that. And that's the ideal. The ideal is when God shows up in your bedroom, your car, your shower, when you're crying your eyes out over some painful thing in your life. And to me, that's the better part of love. Love goes there. Love cares so much about the person that, I even had a moment with this prodigal story again, which is one of my favorites anyway, but how much you have to love somebody to let them go. and to say, if you're better off without me, I'll let you go. That's an amazing place to be. And And so that was a big undercurrent, particularly the time in Holland, because I was at a couple of those places. Even after I spoke about God being intimate with us, it was, you know, we're going to do soaking and, you know, do all these things to try to somehow. And I look at people going through almost this in anguish, trying to find God in the very thing I was hoping people would see a little differently. And maybe they will in time, but it's the deal. It's what we do. It's a, you know, we have a service, we have a teaching, and then we have a come to get to God time. And I hope it helps people. I really do. I'm not dissing at all. I'm not trying to, but
yeah, I mean, I think the reality is what's going on in each individual heart. Yeah. I know there's times that I have just ached for God. And so there's a sense of searching for him, not as if he's not there, but there's a longing.
Yeah. I love that.
And if that's what's driving that longing up the hill, that can be amazing. If it is a performance and, you know, you must somehow show yourself approved, that's the stuff that I think that creates hurdles and barriers.
Yeah.
That none of us really have the goods to somehow make it. And I think that's very discouraging to people. And so, you know, I think it's a real question of what. Because I know this, you know, there's a measure of what I think God plays as a loving pursuit where I know I'm being pursued. And then I think there's also moments that he sort of withdraws so as to draw me out.
Mm.
And it's almost like a little bit of, you know, divine hide and seek. And if it was like he's hiding so as to not be found, that would not be cool.
Not thinking that'd be fun. No.
But if it's to draw me out, I've appreciated those moments where it's like there is a sense of journey in it. And the fact that we don't control it and that it's, you know, because I know that we've used the whole analogy of the fact that it's a dance, you know, and it's like, what kind of dance is it right now? And I don't think it's just one way. And so I think when it's fabricated or prescribed on people, as opposed to meeting people with, you know, where are they at?
Yeah.
Your daughter in tears did not need a pep talk.
Nope.
She needed a hold.
A shoulder. Yep.
Yeah. And then, but I think there's other times that, you know, frankly, I do know and experience that, you know, God kind of gives that little pat on the butt that says, hey, come on, we're over here.
Yeah. Yeah, I just like not seeing that as even in the positive sense of that we've got this staircase to climb into this palace. I know God's enthroned on the heavens and it's the most exquisite place in the world, and we're going to get there someday, and it's going to make all these palaces and cathedrals look like doggy poo, you know? I realize that, but I love when I'm in that place of feeling lost and wanting to kind of seek him. It's not so much I've got to go somewhere. But it's how do I see through what's going on right here and find you? That to me, that's the deal. And I don't think he hides himself. I honestly think my flesh gets in the way of me seeing what he's already about. I think he's wanting to open that quickly, and maybe sometimes why he doesn't jump out of the bushes right away is because as I turn my heart towards him, I'm letting go of things I need to let go to see him better. And I'm all about that. I think that's great. So, anyway, that was fun. I found myself having a lot of time to talk about that with people. And I met a music guy that I met in Germany a year and a half ago. He did some song stuff right before I spoke at this retreat out in a home in the woods. And he was not going to be in Holland when I was there, and I was disappointed. I was looking forward to seeing him. And then he walked into this last thing I was doing on Sunday night, in a more traditional congregational structure. He comes walking in, and he's in the back of the room, and I just went, wow. He was recording in the UK. That's why he wasn't going to be there. And he came in, and I got a chance to talk to him just briefly afterwards, but he just talked about how much the teaching of He Loves Me, how much that he'd been part of at the retreat with me, had changed the whole songs he was writing. And I got a chance to listen to some of them, because he gave me a website I could go download. I download his latest CD, and they've all switched. It's opening to the God of affection. It's not the high holy climb up to the holy mountain and get in God's face. It's just stopping enough, quieting enough to turn around and see this Father's always been there hunting you down. And he was telling me how much that had salted into a big part of his life. And he's a big time guy in Holland in terms of singing and worship, and people drag him around all kinds of events. And, you know, he's a gifted guy. But to see that change in his heart just over a God is more intimate than God is more distant, pretty cool. Yeah,
I think that whole realm of worship is, we're in need of some fresh language because it's gone to a fresh place. You know, if what your repertoire of songs and song singing doesn't match with kind of where God's at, it really is a challenge to be stuck with the form of, okay, well, we're supposed to sing songs now. Well, what songs are you supposed to sing? What is God wanting to do with us on, you know, because I look at that, it's like, that can be an incredibly manipulative thing, or it can be an incredible facilitation. It's just a question of, is your language matching what God is actually doing?
Yeah.
And do you have a sense of what that is? Because if it's just strike up the band, you end up going like, gosh, we can go through all these right motions that on the surface, how would you criticize them? Yeah. But if they're not in keeping with what the Lord's trying to say and do, that's where it's like, guess what? Form, it should follow function. If all we got is form, that can be frustrating.
I think that Marshall McLuhan quote, which you used before, we humans shape their tools, and the tools end up shaping us. And I think, you know, in the early days when, gosh, 40 years ago, you're going to a Sunday morning event, and it's a pretty, you know, singing a hymn, choir anthem. It's pretty distant. I mean, some people love that. I get that, but I never loved it. And then guitars and choruses and something more intimate, and somebody just would help you have an opportunity to engage God. And that became wonderful. And then that's become, over 40 years now, orchestrated into a whole...
We've got some rock concerts going.
Well, not just the rock, but the methodology is such that now we're driving you into something. And we're, you know, the push and the prophetic element of come to my holy mountain, come, and come without your disappointments, come without your doubts. I'm going, oh my gosh, what hope have most people of doing that? I mean, it really just says, I'm hearing it now. And I used to do that, lead that kind of stuff back in the day. And I said dumb things too. So I'm not trying to rag on folks, but I just look at the normal person saying, okay, I'm not good enough for God the way I am, so I'm going to pretend to be different for the next 35, 40 minutes of this quote-unquote worship event. But they're going to walk out of the room, and it's not going to be different, because I don't think it's as real an environment as it was when we were younger, and it had less morphed into this, even down to the beat and the meter and the key, which they're trained in to kind of group dynamics lead the group, what they, you know, the high holy praise. And, you know, it, you can, now I watch it happening in a room and I'm just not excited. And I don't even know if the musician's all that aware of what he's doing. He's just learned how to move a crowd into the space he wants them to move into. I think most of them are really genuine about that. I don't think they're, you know, get up in the morning and go, how can I twist this crowd into some, but I still think some of the conventions they're using are not, look, I'm going to sing here and you join me when you want and let's enjoy God together. It is, I've got to move you, you pathetic, disgusting Christian, into some high holy praise moment so God can show up here.
I think if that's what's actually going on, yeah, that's a little bit crazy. I just know, back in January, I took Jared with me to, and some friends putting on this big deal in the Atlanta Dome. They had 40,000 college students. And I got to tell you, we had some of the most amazing times of a kind of corporate worship that were such a breath of fresh air. Because this is 40,000 kids going hard after God, not with a, I have to.
Yeah.
But with a genuine passion for it. One of the meetings, you know, they would have worship things that would start at 11 p.m., get over somewhere around 1:30.
See, I'm not even going to those.
I know. We were back in the hotel room, and what was so fascinating is we had gotten back, and you got 40,000 kids who are dismissing. through the streets of Atlanta, they're still singing this one chorus that's just wafting through the streets. It was awesome. And so I think genuine, it was the kind of thing that would stop your heart. You'd go like, what's going on? And we ended up peering out the window as you're just watching all these kids milling around. And this spontaneous, you know, just chorus is being sung in the streets. And I'm going like, how cool is that? So, I mean, I look at all of it and it's like, yeah, that can be a manipulated, forced driving the herd up the wrong mountain. But it can also be a glorious expression of a point of corporate connection. Then I just end up going like, I think the common denominator is it real? Are you forcing someone to feel like if you don't come with us, something's wrong with you? Or are you simply making a moment available? And I think it has everything to do with the people up front and what's going on with them.
I do, but my test at the end of the day is this. Can those people who have those moving moments and this whole orchestrated environment, music and drums and all the things they do, can they wake up the next morning and engage the same God that they awake to and has a sense that he's in their life? And that's when I have that, I'm at peace. I don't care what you do. If what you're doing in the bigger event makes God seem a million miles away from you on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that's where I go. I don't care what you're doing. I think it's kind of got God backwards. So let's find him. I don't mind moments of songs and praise alongside people who are engaging God freely. I think that's all good stuff too. So pretty cool.
Yeah, man.
So have you heard? Did you hear any Jack Gray or John Beaumont stuff, or did you not get a chance to chase the podcast?
I didn't get a chance to listen to him. I did poke at kind of the responses. It sounded like the last guy that God filled nobody was a breath of fresh air to people.
A big, yeah, and I think both of them were. I've gotten tons of even personal email from both people who listened and enjoyed the Jack Gray thing and then the John Beaumont. John Beaumont, by the way, I somehow my talking to him that day lit a fire under that guy. And I had some of his friends just saying, you know, this guy's mostly just talking about can't wait to see what's beyond the grave. And now he's just been repassioned. In fact, he wrote a new article out of some of our discussion, but it wasn't anything that we talked about, just kind of what fueled in his heart. He sent it to me this week. It's called Jesus is Building His Church, and it's an incredibly positive thing. So I'm going to post it on the website so people who want to get a little more John Beaumont have a chance to do that. But, I have enjoyed these two brothers, and I have all over the world had people tell me what a joy it was to, and how they've rethought some of the older people in their life that you kind of sideline and think, you know, what do they got to give? And I would go all the way to New Zealand to talk to them. And then people just go, man, there's just a rich heritage there. I want to see what rich heritage I'm missing around me, which I think is a great takeaway from that.
Absolutely.
I think that's a great takeaway. So pretty cool.
Well, welcome home.
Thank you. It's good to be home.
Get a few good night's sleep.
But I'm fixing to get on a plane in about 4 days and head off to France. So I'm just going, oh, God, did I schedule all this right? Is this, I'm hoping that the situation at home is resolved enough by then so that's not something that's going to add to that. But I'm going over for a week of meeting with the publisher who's done two of my books in French. And they've got people kind of coming a retreat for the weekend from a pretty broad area. So we're going to go over and do that. Yeah, and then I've got a crazy trip. I'm going to spend most of my time in France on trains going across France and then back across France again and then back across France again. But going from there down to more toward the southern coast, and there's a group of folks going to meet there on a Monday. And then Tuesday I'm training into Paris from way in the south end to meet Sarah, who's going to be arriving by plane. And then we're taking another train from there out to Angiers, where we've got a community of believers that wanted to hang out with me since I was going to be in the area and asked if I'd come. So we're going to go out and do that and spend... I'm going to explore the Loire Valley, which I've always wanted to do, because I think there's some palaces there or some, you know, summer residences or something. I find those things fascinating, even as I hate the people who built them.
You go, boy.
But they're dead, so I don't carry a lot of resentment. But we're going to spend some time with them, and then Sarah and I are training back into Paris, and we're going to take 4 days to celebrate our anniversary together. And
how many years?
It'll be 37.
Wow, you should get a medal.
Actually, next week it'll be 37, but I won't be here. I'm going to be up in San Francisco doing a bridge builder event, but I already got approval from Sarah. Sarah's not a date freak like some people are. We celebrate day before, day after. A week later in Paris is fine. So
there you go.
We're going to do some of that, and then we're going to go from there to Ireland to meet with some of our Irish friends for 5-6 days, and then we'll come home. And then hopefully I don't have to crawl on another international bird for a long time.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.